Hey team, today is a live podcast recording that I recorded on September 23rd, and it was on Instagram, and now I'm going to put it on my podcast. We talk a lot about why I don't like pellets. There's a lady, I hope the audio goes through it. It doesn't in the beginning, but this lady called into the podcast. You can actually do a voice memo on Anchor to my podcast, because that's where my podcast is hosted, and she said I was quickly dismissive of pellets, and I was like, damn straight I am quickly dismissive of pellets. Like, literally nobody recommends them. If you go to the Journal of Sexual Medicine, International Society for the Study of Women's Sexual Health, Clinical Practice Guidelines for the Use of Systemic Testosterone for Hypoactive Sexual Desire Disorder in Women, that's a mouthful. It's in 2021, literally on one of their pages. They say, key takeaway messages, compounded testosterone, pellets, IM injections, and oral formulations are not recommended. So that and more in this month's second. I did two live podcast recordings in September because summer got away from me. August was like a day long, I think. So in order to get on the Zoom link for October, so you know when it is ahead of time, go to kellycaspersonmd.com and get on my email list, and then you can find out more and be involved. So it was cool today. I had a lady come in and talk about her condition and kind of what she was looking for. And as always, this is for educational and entertainment purposes only. I'm not your medical doctor, unless I am. But if I am, I'm still not giving you medical advice on social media or podcasts, because you get to come see me. So I love you all so much. And remember, you are not broken. Enjoy this live podcast recording. Take it away. Welcome to You Are Not Broken, the only podcast that combines science, medicine, and psychology to re-educate your brain and help you live your best love life. And I'm your host, board-certified female urologist, Dr. Casperson. Check my
eyes. Is that better?
There you go. Yeah, sorry, there you go. Awesome.
I'm not really good at this stuff, this technical stuff, but we're having to learn, aren't we?
Yeah, right.
Last year, I mean, this is just a personal problem, obviously, I can't, but I'm 67, and I started HRT last year. I've only been on one pump of estrogel and one eutrogestan tablet, and I've had a lot of bleeds, which I can't seem to get on top of. Mm-hmm. But then last year, I started having some UTIs. I had three recurrent UTIs. So I was given three lots of antibiotics. And then I had what the doctor told me was thrush. Mm-hmm. So I had an antibiotic. Then I had Vagifem, which really caused me some burning. And then I was given a thrush pessary. And after those three lots of internal pessaries, I lost a lot of skin. And I've been in a lot of pain ever since. I've been sort of looked at for vulvodynia. I was given amitriptyline, which helped quite a lot. I felt I was improving a little bit. But I worked my way off the amitriptyline, and I feel I'm starting to burn again. And I don't know if this is too personal for this kind of a meeting, you know.
It's a public forum, and I can't give medical advice, but yeah. I think your bravery in sharing it, because I guarantee you, Janet, that you are not the only person who's gone through this. This is so incredibly common, but women don't know that other people are suffering. So it's, you're almost doing a service to everybody else in trying to answer your own question, if that makes sense.
Good.
To me, what it could sound like is almost like a contact dermatitis, either from a product or from a infection, like almost like the internal vagina is sloughing and you're losing that kind of protective endothelial barrier. So vaginismus or vaginitis are very just generic terms, meaning like painful vagina. So, you know, when you say I'm being worked up for that, it's like, of course, you have a painful vagina. That's what you have. But finding out why, I think, is what's most important. I agree with, you know, things that prevent UTIs, things that prevent thrush is vaginal estrogen. So it's almost like now you're trying to like put out the fire instead of like preventing it in the first place. A lot of people have the same question. Systemic HRT, systemic hormones, doesn't protect the vagina from UTIs and thrush yeast, stuff like that. So you should, not should, but a lot of people would consider being on both, right? Because you can be on systemic hormones and still have low estrogen in the vulva and vagina, because simply being on systemic hormones, it's still not a huge estrogen dose. It's not giving you a 30-year-old estrogen dose. So kind of protecting, because a lot of people will say, like, why am I still getting that if I'm on systemic hormones? It's almost as if they're for two different things, even though we're calling it all estrogen. Does that make sense?
I daren't obviously try the Vagifem again. That I just wouldn't dare try it again because of the initial burning it caused.
Yeah.
But I mean, and over here we don't have estradiol cream. We have estriol cream, but not estradiol.
Estradiol, right. Yeah. Our cream here is estradiol. That's the generic cream. The other thing to consider, especially if we have very sensitive, this is for all women in general, if we have really sensitive skin, whether it's just from lack of estrogen or it's because we've been fighting infections or we just have, you know, skin all over our body that's sensitive, is if you have a compounding pharmacy, you can actually go try the creams that they have without any hormones in it, just to see if you tolerate the cream. Right. Because sometimes it's just the cream. It's either it's got too much alcohol in it or it's just, you know, causing sensitive skin irritation. So some women will say, give me your cream products. I'll go home and experiment, see what I tolerate. Then let's put the estrogen in there.
Right.
Which is a nice way to suss out, like, is it the estrogen that's causing the problem or it's the, you know, the product?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. I don't know of any compounding pharmacies over here, but I'm sure they'll be on the website of some, you know, can look them up.
Yeah, it'd just be things to try, because certainly just hoping it doesn't happen again. I don't love hope as a plan.
Right. What do you think to estriol cream?
If it's all you have, it's better than nothing, I would think. It tends to not be absorbed as well, just, and that's why we don't use it systemically, except for some compounded people will use it. So I tend to go with what our FDA products are, because I know that that's more trusted. But I, again, when I get into different countries and what their pharmacies and what they like, it's out of my wheelhouse at that point.
Okay. Thank you.
Absolutely. Much love. Thanks for sharing your story.
Thank you.
All right. Does anybody else want to come on and ask some questions? Somebody said you can get the jelly in the UK. So that might be a possible. Let's see if the jelly is not irritating. Is vaginal estrogen still needed and are helpful if already on systemic estrogen or progesterone? I think we just answered that. Yes, in the majority of cases, I think there are some women who it's enough that they don't, their vulva and their vagina does get enough from systemic, but certainly I see a lot that it's not enough. They'll still have very atrophic dryness, pain, irritation, infections, even though they're on systemic hormones. Systemic meaning body, vaginal meaning local or pelvic. I should start calling it pelvic estrogen. Number one, social media doesn't love when I use terms vulva, vagina, clitoris. Social media is against using female body parts, I guess. But using it, you love my hair. That's so nice. This is why I do things live. Even if I call it pelvic estrogen, it is a way more for it to seem that it's not going all over the place, because a lot of people do ask that. So now I will go on to, I have so many questions from Instagram, you guys. It's insane. So I will see how many I can get to in the time we have remaining. So I have a voice memo actually from the podcast, and it's about testosterone. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to play it to see if you guys can hear it. It's about systemic testosterone in women, and it's just lovely that she sent me a voicemail. So if you go to Anchor, anchor.fm is owned by Spotify. You can actually like send me a voice thing if you want to, but I think you can do that on Instagram too. But it's kind of a fun thing. So let me go to see if I can find my voice file. Or not. Anchor is owned by Spotify, so it's kind of big. And that's where I host my stuff from. Okay, here's my messages. So see if you guys can hear this.
Hi, I'm a listener from Missouri. I was recommended your podcast by my gynecologist in Missouri. And I have a question about your testosterone podcast. You indicated that pellets could not be altered in the form of their dose. And I am looking at one that my gynecologist recommended, which is Avexipel. And it does say, and she said, that she would recommend a dose based on my needs. And we did a testosterone blood draw, and I have low testosterone, 0.4, and I'm postmenopausal, 64 years old, low libido. I'm curious why you talked about pellets and discarded them so quickly in your podcast. Thank you.
Okay, so just in case anybody didn't hear that, that is Lori from Missouri, and her gynecologist wants her to be on pellets, and her testosterone is low. You gave your testosterone dose as 0.4, which makes me think that was a calculated free testosterone dose, because that free testosterone dose goal will tend to be 0.6 to 0.8, but the new guidelines for the use of systemic testosterone shows they just want you to use total testosterone now. Anyways, whatever. Your experts should know what they're talking about. So she rightly picked up on the fact that I rapidly dismissed pellets, because that's how feisty I am, and I rapidly dismiss things when I don't want to deal with them. So pellets are a way to make money. Pellets are also a way to market hormones towards women. Pellets are a way to empty your wallet quickly because they tend to be expensive. Pellets are a way to become supra therapeutic on testosterone, meaning getting you up way over what normal should be. Pellets are, I mean, to me, I'm like, why are they necessary unless you are selling them to make some money, which you're not. You're wanting to just feel better, but your provider might think it's a way. I have nothing to win or lose. I don't do pellets. So like, I only see them for that, because why would you use pellets and put something under your skin when you can just use a cream that it's dirt cheap, that's FDA approved, that you know you aren't going to overshoot on, and certainly can be just as whatever streamlined to your needs means. There's no FDA. Yes, thank you for reminding me that. Pellets are not FDA approved. Pellets are not approved by North American Menopause Society. Pellets are not approved by the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecologists. There is no mainstream medical board that says pellets are the gold standard. There are plenty of papers, and I should do a podcast on this, don't you think? But I should do a podcast on it. There are multiple papers showing the harm and worsening side effects of pellets compared to your standard FDA approved over the counter, not over the counter, but FDA approved products that tend to be cheaper as well. So what I see is women are suffering. They go to their regular doctor who doesn't know anything about perimenopause, and they get blown off. So then they go to a hormone clinic, and then the hormone clinic says, I will tailor this to you, and let's check a bunch of expensive labs and saliva tests, which again are not recommended. And we'll give you pellets so you become dependent on coming to me for your pellets instead of just going somewhere to get an FDA-approved medication. So if that's me being dismissive, that's also me just following the rule books on what NAMS and ISHWISH, their statement is. I did not get into perimenopause and menopause knowledge and education to, like, number one, to make money, number two, to do anything against what the guidelines are. Like, hormones have side effects. Taking too many hormones can have side effects. We think taking appropriately dosed testosterone in female doses, specifically for low desire, in the postmenopause setting is very, very safe. And I'm going to hold up this article because I just happen to have it here. This is what I do on vacation, you guys. Internet, this is the Ishwish, International Society for the Study of Women's Sexual Health Clinical Practice Guidelines for the Use of Systemic Testosterone for Hypoactive Sexual Desire Disorder in Women. I can literally turn the page and show you where they say don't do pellets. So if that's me being dismissive quickly with pellets, why waste time on things that aren't recommended? Let's see if I can actually find it and not bore you guys to death. Don't use pellets. There you go. This is in the Journal of Sexual Medicine, and this is from 2021. So if you want to find this, bring it to your provider and say, hey, there's guidelines on what you should do to use this. So there you go. I will try to find you the pellets thing, but I don't want to waste too much money on this. Here you go. Page 858, compounded testosterone, pellets, intramuscular injections, and oral formulations are not recommended. There you go. I'm not dismissive. I am accurate. Accurate, evidence-based. God bless. There you go. So why not ask your gynecologist if you can use female dosing of the male product, which literally is pennies to the dollar. You buy a 30-day supply, which is the male dose, 1/10 of the dose for female. It's 300 days worth of testosterone, and nothing has to, you're not dependent upon a pellet. Just heard a horrible side effect. Anecdotal is not the way to get your healthcare, by the way, but an anecdote is a woman had pellets. They get super high testosterone doses, and then she started having male pattern balding, which can get better once you stop the testosterone, but boy, it's a rough lesson to learn to not use pellets. Also, they're freaking expensive. Spend your money on other things. Okay, so let's see. Going to the questions, postmenopausal bleeding. Somebody had said, I had posted on Instagram today, what do you want me to talk about on my live? Postmenopausal bleeding was one of them, and I'm not a gynecologist. Postmenopausal bleeding is never considered normal. You can have a little bit of spotting just when you're starting hormone replacement therapy, but see your primary care gynecologist. You probably need a pelvic ultrasound to rule out endometrial cancer, endometrial thickening. I'm going to have a gynecologist on here who's an expert in fibroids and postmenopausal bleeding. She's also going to talk about perimenopause and how the bleeding just goes a little bit haywire, gets irregular, gets really heavy, because I really want people to understand why that's happening in the perimenopause time, which again can be the years up to menopause. So there's postmenopausal bleeding question. Coconut oil for vulvar dryness. Why not? If you like it, if it's soothing, it's soothing. We use coconut oil for other places on our body. I don't think there's anything wrong with it. Two thoughts on it. Number one, it doesn't solve anything. It's not actually healing the skin. It's not actually treating the reason that you're having postmenopausal dryness, which is the estrogen. So again, if you're actively being treated for breast cancer, great option for non-hormonal treatment of low estrogen. But most women are perfectly fine to get on hormonal vaginal estrogen, what I call pelvic estrogen. So coconut oil is a band-aid, not a solution. So in a woman that can't be on pelvic estrogen, it's a great idea. Certainly if you're on pelvic estrogen and you still find it soothing, some people use it for sexual lubrication, go for it. I'm not against it unless you're getting yeast infections or urinary tract infections, because coconut oil is a food. Don't feed your bugs. So those are my thoughts on coconut oil. Somebody had said relaxing pelvic floor. I don't know what this means. It could mean my pelvic floor is too relaxed, like I have prolapse. I have too relaxed of a pelvic floor, or is this meaning I want to learn how to relax my pelvic floor? So they just said relaxing pelvic floor. Stereotypically, I think this person might be asking how to relax the pelvic floor. Starting to kind of get into the biomechanics of what your pelvic floor is doing, because it's not something we ever pay attention to. You can put your hand down on the outside of the vulva, see what happens with breath, see what happens when you pull in and lift, which is what a Kegel is. Trained physical therapists, think of it like this. If you have a tight shoulder, you can't just be like, I'm going to just think my shoulder loose. It doesn't usually work that way. You need a physical therapist to be like, you've got tension here, you've got a knot here, you've got some constriction pulling from your latissimus over there. I have tight shoulders, so I always like using tight shoulders and the like, I can't will my shoulder looser. I got to go to somebody to be like, here's this stretch, here's what you can do when you find it getting tight. Like somebody who's actually trained in it, pelvic floor physical therapists worth their weight in gold, you guys. Highly recommend it. Next question, intra-rosa treatment for genital urinary symptoms of menopause. Love it. So intra-rosa, generic's called prasterone. It's a newer medication. That's never a good thing because newer medications are expensive. You guys think vaginal estrogen is expensive? You should see what intra-rosa costs. Medicare did something this year where they made it, they put it into a class like a lifestyle medication, or they put it in like the sexual dysfunction medication or something like that. I literally had trouble getting this covered for somebody because the insurance company didn't treat sexual dysfunction. And I'm like, what part of taking care of your vagina is sexual function? Like it's an organ that needs to be taken care of. That's important in preventing urinary tract infections. That's important in preventing yeast infections. It's all important. It has nothing to do with sex. So that's the stereotype women's bodies have, you guys. Our stereotype is like insurance company isn't covering your vaginal prescription because they don't cover sexual medicine. That's insane. That's like not covering a steroid cream that some penises need because they've got certain skin conditions on their penis because the penis is a sexual organ. Like, of course their skin cream would get covered. It's a skin problem. Same with the vagina. It's a skin problem. Rant over. Intra-rosa is great. It tends to be expensive. You have to dose it every day. It comes in a very nice suppository. It works wonderfully. It works by, it's a precursor hormone that converts into both estrogen and testosterone in the vulvar tissues. It's very safe. It's great. I love it. Why not? Again, it's only pelvic. It's not systemic. There is no evidence to say systemic DHEA, which is what prasterone is beneficial and not harmful systemically in women. So stay away. As of right now, the guidelines say stay away from DHEA systemically, but vaginally with your intra-rosa and your prasterone is totally cool. Let's see, the part progesterone plays in hormone replacement therapy. Such a good question, you guys. So progesterone is there to protect the lining of the uterus. What that means is if you don't have a uterus, you don't have to take progesterone. Now, some people will argue you can take progesterone because it actually helps with sleep and relaxing and can help in the poor sleep component of menopause. But I would argue if you don't have a uterus, so you don't need to protect your uterus, you don't need to take progesterone. And in the Women's Health Initiative study, if there was any risk at all, which you can argue that there isn't, but if there, let's go with the fact that there was some risk of taking hormones and risk of breast cancer, it was in the estrogen progesterone arm, not in the estrogen alone arm. Meaning if you don't have to take progesterone, maybe you don't want to, because if there's anything nefarious about it, it's the progesterone arm. Now, to get a little more on that, that was using oral progesterone. You can also use progesterone as an IUD or vaginally to help protect the uterus. Maybe that's a lower risk of breast cancer. But again, it's a lot of assumptions. You took a study that wasn't even randomized to test for breast cancer and you made an assumption out of it. That assumption is the progesterone's the evil player. The next assumption is an IUD is a so much lower dose, which if you need to protect your uterus, maybe an IUD instead of oral progesterone. So there you go. Progesterone is there to protect your uterus. How do we know this? We know this because back in the day, before we knew this, and we just gave women high doses of estrogen for their hormone, for their menopause symptoms, back in the day, like grandparents' day, 40s, 50s, stuff like that, those women had a 5 to 10% increased risk of uterine cancer compared to women that weren't on estrogen, meaning estrogen causes cell proliferation of the uterine lining, which can lead to uterine cancer. So you get that back down to normal by protecting the uterus with progesterone. So there you go. Next question. Yeah, I love my Mirena. Totally. Mirena is awesome. It's a great way to be on birth control during the perimenopause symptom so you can start being on estrogen and still have your uterus protected. So it's an awesome thing to do. That I think, again, This is just an opinion. There are many different ways of doing things because there are many different people. But IUD, progesterone IUD, combined with an estrogen ring systemically dosed, you're going to get vaginal and systemic estrogen out of that one. It's called estring, femring. It's called femring, not estring. Estring is just the, so there's two different estrogen doses. One's systemic, one's estrogen only. One's a higher dose, one's a lower dose. So that would be my like perfect, ideal, stress-free, low maintenance hormone replacement therapy. And some FDA approved testosterone dosed for women off label for low desire. That is my perfect. If you wanted me to paint the picture of wonderful hormone replacement therapy, there you go. That's just one way of doing it, you guys. There's so many different ways of doing it. There's patches. There's all these different awesome ways to do it. But I just wanted to give you guys some awesome ones. Okay, what are we doing? Can estradiol pelvic cream cause periods to start again? Too frequent use, maybe. Maybe, especially if you have a really thin vagina that hasn't had seen estrogen in a while, you might get a little more systemic absorption than if you've been on it for a while. So it could, especially if you're in the very early menopause and you just needed a little bit more estrogen to start you cycling again. Again, if you're technically postmenopause, you should be checked for abnormal pelvic bleeding. Does an ablation in tubal cause any issues with libido or pain with sex? Any surgeries in the pelvis can cause pain with sex, scar tissue, all that. So certainly there could be something there. But no, libido is complicated, and libido does not involve. So what's ablation and what is an ablation in a tubal, you guys? Ablation is destruction of the uterine lining, so you don't have any more periods, and a tubal is removal of your fallopian tubes. You still have ovaries that can release eggs, if they just can't get into the uterus to get pregnant. So think about what those are. Do any of those affect hormones? Nope. Shouldn't affect. Now, having surgery in the pelvis can be a stress, which can affect hormones. Yes. But just having an ablation in a tubal doesn't affect any hormones. So shouldn't affect your libido as far as hormones go, but realize libido is multifactorial, bio, psycho, social. That would just be the bio, psycho still there, stresses, relationships, social, how you're socialized as a woman, do you believe menopausal women should be sexual, all of that stuff that affects your libido. So short answer, no. Long answer, it's complicated. Can you discuss vaginismus? Sure. So vaginismus tends to be the tightening of the muscles around the vagina, preventing penetration, which would be either sexual in nature or tampon, for periods, basically any insertion. Seems to be two things. Number one, cognitive sex therapy to help deal with any sort of stress response or history that could have led up to this. Number two, pelvic floor physical therapy to help, again, work on that control of the pelvis, relaxation, accepting, allowing penetration, putting you back in control and in charge of that. I've seen it work very, very well. So there isn't a great pill for that. There's not a great surgery for that. So don't think of it in terms of like a Western medicine sort of way to fix it. Western medicine in air quotes. But like, it is really it's fixable. Women get better. Women meet their goals, but you've got to do some work. Tends to be cognitive therapy as well as pelvic floor physical therapy. Vaginismus is very common, you guys. Very, very common. So you're not alone. But if you don't do anything, it doesn't tend to get better on its own, in my experience. So that would be something. This is a nice comment. I've been preaching your info and sharing your links with my mom for months. Her doctor finally gave her a prescription after multiple UTIs. We were so excited, but then the doctor bill was going to be the prescription bill was going to be $480. So a couple of things on that. Number one, make sure your doctor knows that vaginal estrogen is generic. This is in America, the generic estradiol cream, should be getting it somewhere between $60 and $100. If you go on the Good RX app, on your phone. Just go to your app store, type in GoodRx. It's becoming very popular now. You can type in your zip code and the medication. It'll tell you where the cheapest one is. You can get your prescription transferred there. Another thing to do is to call or get a hold of your prescription drug coverage and say, I need a vaginal estrogen that's reasonably priced. The more they hear about that from women, the more hopefully they'll realize they need to price this as a preventative medicine that you're going to be on lifelong. This is not a 5-day course like an antibiotic. This is something you need to be on. As soon as you stop using your vaginal estrogen, your risks of urinary tract infection go back up. So you call your pharmacy and they could be like, oh, well, turns out Vagifem tabs are like $5 a month. I had some ladies, going back to the vaginal estrogen ring, that tends to be an expensive way to do it. Granted, it's for 3 months, not so, you know, divided by three, whatever that cost is. I had one woman, she got hers for $20. Her insurance coverage was like $20 for her vaginal estrogen ring, $20 for 3 months. Oh my gosh. I tend to say if it's, you know, $80 or $100 and it's prevented one UTI, it's paid for itself because it costs money to go see a doctor for a UTI and get an antibiotic. Does menopause tighten the entrance to the vagina? Yes. Short answer, yes. Couple of things. Some people, but not in everybody. Long answer, not in everybody. So the vulva, the entrance to the vagina has a name, first of all. It's called vulva. You're welcome. If we don't use our correct body parts, watch Instagram kick me off for this. If we don't use our correct body parts, we can't communicate our needs with our partners, our romantic partners, as well as our physician partners. Entrance to your vagina is called a vulva. The organ of pleasure in women is called the clitoris. How many people learn that when they learn sex ed? Very few. I didn't. It like literally the clitoris didn't exist. So not everybody will have a tight vulva. Introitus is also a name of the entrance to the vagina, but it's not an organ. Introitus is not an organ. Vulva is an organ. Vulva is the labia, the clitoris, the urethral opening, vulva. Introitus just means entrance. So you could also say introitus. If you say introitus to your doctor, they're actually going to think you're pretty well read. So drop that one. They'll be impressed. Some people have laxity after menopause. Remember, women lose muscle strength as we age. So do men. You had a couple of kids. You aren't strong. You haven't done weightlifting. You're not eating to prioritize muscle strength and growth, aka protein. You have some laxity. So you can get vulvar introital external vaginal laxity, or it could get tight. It'll get tight because the skin gets dry, it loses its collagen, it loses its blood flow. Those are all low estrogen effects of postmenopause on the vulva and the introitus. So yes, the other thing, you guys, is if you don't put things in your vagina on a regular basis, it can get tighter because it's like not used to putting, that's why vaginal dilation is recommended by a lot of physical therapists. For whatever reason, you had surgery down there or it's tight or you want to get back into sexual activity, but it's too tight, is like reminding it of the game you want it to play, right? It's like, I literally can't go out and run a marathon, but if I trained for it, I could, right? So like women who aren't sexually active, literally they put something in their vagina and then they're like, ah, that was not good. I can't do that again. It's like, you have to train up to it. Tell the body, you know, what you're expecting of it, because you will get that tightness. You will get that inelasticity if you're not sexually active. But again, that's the last thing I want is anybody to start this myth of like, you have to have sex so you don't get tight. Like, no, there's plenty of people we do surgery on because they're too loose, right? So it's a spectrum. Everybody's different. Too much looseness, that's called prolapse. You have to do surgery to fix it. Too much tightness, that's called dyspareunia and pain with sex. You have to do something. So like there's no preferred state there. They're just all examples of how our body can come into being in a position that doesn't work for us very well. Is hormone replacement therapy safe for someone with atherosclerosis? So confused. So this is why most modern HRT recommendations recommend starting estrogen in early menopause or within 10 years of it. The older you are when you start, the more heart disease and atherosclerosis has already started. It's probably putting you at a bigger risk for stroke, heart disease, heart attack by then putting you on hormones. I don't think atherosclerosis in and of itself is a contraindication But any existing heart disease does have to be addressed with your provider when you're going on hormones, because it does increase your risk factor in general for future heart attacks, strokes, heart disease, things like that. So again, I don't think it's a contraindication, but certainly when we talk about risks and benefits of hormones, the healthier you are, the healthier you are, right? That sounds so stupid for me to say it like that, but like sometimes it's just so simple. Okay. I'm 53 years old. I'm starting to have hot flashes during the night. I was wondering if a vaginal estrogen cream might relieve me and improve my sleep. No, it will not. Vaginal estrogen cream is for the pelvis. Systemic hormones are for hot flashes, prevention of osteoporosis, prevention of memory issues, starting to get more and more. The North American Menopause Society is literally having their yearly conference right now. I have some friends there. I'm literally like chomping at the bit to hear from them on what they're learning about the brain and being on estrogen. I think we're going to see more and more and more data looking at decreased risk of Alzheimer's disease by being on hormone replacement therapy. We have data that says if you already have Alzheimer's disease, being on giving yourself hormones won't help. But the big question is, what if we have a healthy 53-year-old woman, she wants to be on hormone replacement therapy, and we follow all those women? Are they going to have less Alzheimer's disease, dementia, anxiety, depression, than the women who say, I don't want to be on it, or I can't be on it, whatever the reason might be? This is a paper. Do you like how I just carry academic papers on my desk? You're welcome. This is a paper coming out of Arizona, the Brain Science, University of Arizona, association between menopausal hormone therapy and risks of neurodegenerative diseases. Is systemic estrogen good? My ND said no. Your ND doesn't know the current guidelines. You guys, step back a second. Good, bad. What's good for one person is not good for another person. What's bad for one person is not bad for another person. Our brains want to overly simplify, and that's an overly simplified question of, is systemic estrogen good? Like, maybe it's great for you. Maybe your naturopath just is still on the like estrogen is bad bandwagon. Estrogen was never bad. We just had a really crappy study in the early 2000s that like tried to oversimplify it. So I am not here to say estrogen is good for everybody. I'm not here to say estrogen's bad for everybody. But if a provider is just like, it's bad, that's like me being like, cocaine is bad. Like, cocaine is bad for everybody. I actually think alcohol is bad for everybody at this point in our life. But to overly simplify something is like, it might be great for you. It might be a bad idea for you, but understand it for yourself. Don't just take somebody's like blanket overly simplified statement. Somebody says, I'm willing to be in a study. Dude, put me on hormones and study my brain. Like, take me. That's perfectly fine. So this study, looking at this, so this is not a randomized control trial. What we need is a randomized control trial saying, these people are on estrogen, these people aren't, let's study their brains. But what this is showing is hormone therapy was associated with reduced risks of all neurodegenerative diseases. This was Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, Lou Gehrig's disease, or ALS, which is pretty amazing. But again, this is a chart study looking at a big, big insurance database. So not your best study, but I have not seen a randomized study yet. Randomized, double-blinded, placebo-controlled trial is your best medical trial. Most things aren't that. Is estrogen good if you are 60? Same answer. Do you know that not all 60-year-olds are in the same state of health? I saw this 72-year-old. She's seriously like fitter than me. She's looking like, I'm pretty fit. She is looking so freaking good. Like, seriously, she looked mid-40s. Then I've got women in their mid-50s who literally look like they just don't care at all about vegetables, sleep, stress reduction, or exercise. Like, it shows, you guys, what your priorities are shows in how you look. Like, if I drink alcohol, I don't prioritize my sleep, I don't manage my stress, I don't move my body. Stretching's so good for you. Vegetables, they're amazing for you. In the UK, they say no post 59. Yeah, okay, so that's a little bit more clear. Thank you for clarifying that. The guidelines say the best time to start hormones is within 10 years of menopause. Average age of menopause in America is 51. So most people aren't comfortable starting hormones on, say, a 65-year-old woman. For that reason, your atherosclerosis, your heart disease, your stroke risk, all of those things are already elevated compared to somebody who's going to protect against those things by starting on hormones younger, aka 40s, 50s, something like that. So that might be why they might just say, hey, if you came in and it's been 10 years post starting your menopause, then you don't have options for hormones. Now, it's a little bit cut and dry. I think, you know, some experts, Dr. Heather Hirsch out of Harvard, would say, hey, it should be, if, again, not all 60-year-olds are created equally, but certainly you'd need to accept the risk of starting hormones later is going to put you at a higher risk. Just like the Women's Health Initiative study showed, if you just throw estrogen on 70-year-olds, they don't tend to do as well than if you put a 50-year-old on hormones. So that might be, if those are UK guidelines, that might be where that's coming from. Okay, so going back to that was a ramble. Going back to the question, the 53-year-old starting to have hot flashes, wondering if vaginal estrogen cream might relieve me and improve my sleep. No. Multiple studies have shown no significant raise in the level of body estrogen on vaginal estrogen. So in order to help with hot flashes and sleep related to menopause, the best treatment is estrogen. Estrogen is the most effective treatment for hot flashes compared to beta blockers, antidepressants, blah, 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 black cohosh, which is associated with liver failure, like supplements are not benign. Soy doesn't help. Placebo. So you got to do more estrogen than just vaginal estrogen because it's just not a high enough level. So I hope that helped. All right, guys, let me do one more. To all the people who I said I would get back to you on this or answer it today, I did not get to everybody's question. So join me in October where we will do some more. Okay, here's one more. It's a little bit long, so bear with me. Here's another pellet question. Question about pellets. My OB-GYN just inserted some in me about a month ago. I used to be on hormone replacement shots and patches, then they no longer worked. I want to know what that means. I don't know what that means. Are you testing levels? Are you getting hot flashes? Not sure what that means. I've been talking to my doctor about pellets for years. He was against them. Recently, he's been going to seminars, and now they're FDA approved. Pellets are not FDA approved. Pellets are not FDA approved. So the doctor said, let's try the pellets. So this is where I am. And now I'm concerned because you're saying I shouldn't go this route. Yes, I think you shouldn't do things that aren't FDA approved unless the guidelines say, like, systemic testosterone is not FDA approved, but the formulation and the cream that you can buy is FDA approved, right? So it's a subtle distinction, and I'll spend my whole life like telling people about the differences between all these things. And because like, it's complicated. This is my full-time job and I still don't know all the answers. You're fantastic for answering our questions. Thank you. You are so, so welcome. You guys, literally, you're very, very welcome. I often think, again, my side note, I often think like, who's going to take care of me, right? And a lot of that is my inspiration for like wanting to take care of you guys and making sure you have accurate information and you're not just going to somebody who wants to make money off of you or give you harm or like give you super high testosterone doses so you feel is like high on steroids, because that's what it is. That's why I'm wondering about this question when she's like, they don't work anymore. It's like, are you just not getting like the buzz of high hormones anymore? So love you guys. Oh, I love my podcast too. I was talking to somebody today and I'm calling it my baby, mostly because my other baby's almost out of diapers. And now I need a new baby. And then I suppose I'll get a dog, right? Because I need a new baby. So here we go. Will I please do a podcast about pellets? Doing one right now. This will be up probably within the next week as a podcast. I even tried the Invexi inserts and they are so messy. I don't think Invexi is messy at all, you guys. Do you remember what your vagina did when you were like 22 years old? That's messy. That's like full on hormonally vagina. Invexi is not too messy. Put it in before you go to bed. It'll be done being messy by the time you wake up. I'm 57, so after using different hormone replacements throughout the years, I was excited when I went in for my yearly, you know, my OB-GYN talked to me about the pellets. So, yeah, I wouldn't do the pellets. I would just see what's going on. What are your goals, right? Like, what are your goals with that? Is your goal, like, bone protection and decreased hot flashes, or is your goal to feel, like, super high on high levels of hormones, which is probably not safe? Is your goal like raging spontaneous desire, which I didn't even cover desire in this podcast episode, but like hormones and desire is one teeny small part of the problem, solution, whatever, problem and solution. How you treat your body, how you exercise, how you participate in sex, how you think about sex, how you cultivate your relationship. All that other freaking awesome, juicy stuff is where all the money and the desire is. There is a part of desire that is hormonal, but to think if you're chasing hormones to try to get desire, you got to start thinking outside the box. So that would be my final question for her is like, what are her goals? Is this truly something like she's trying to like get her sexual desire back? And then side note, if you look at all Magnificent Sex by Peggy Kleinpatz, I'm reading it right now. I think I posted it in my stories a couple days ago. She researched all these people with like magnificent sex lives, and it comes down to the experience of having wonderful sex. Not anybody said, you know why I have great sex? It's because I have wonderful spontaneous desire. Nobody says that. So why are we chasing spontaneous desire when you really should be working on having wonderful sex? So going back to this woman and her hormones, I would be like, what's your goal? What are you chasing? What do you want? And I wouldn't think that pellets is the way to get it. So mic drop, stopping with that. I love you guys so much. I'll put this up on the podcast and thank you guys for your support and love. It's literally why I keep doing this. I can't wait to keep growing with you and reaching more and more people. So God bless. And until next time, you are not broken.